5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
This is the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of the city. I'm Jose Candelario here with Jahad Leonard, CTVIP, doing his thing. Thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely. Great morning, Brother Jose.
So tell me a little bit about where did you grow up?
I grew up in Hamden, K through 12, Hamden Public Schools, and from the mean streets of Wintergreen, you know, to college at Morris Brown College.
You're jumping ahead. Tell me a little bit about mom and dad.
Living in a two-parent home. My parents migrated in the early 60s, actually 1961, from Georgia, rural Georgia, Burke County, the largest agrarian county in Georgia. They were sharecroppers. My dad came up to take advantage of the industry that was going on up north to get out of the cotton fields, a couple years older than my mother. And then subsequently, my mother came up and joined him in the early 60s.
But what is his name?
L.J. Jackson. L.J., yes.
And his wife was?
Betty Jackson.
Very good.
Yeah, Betty Jackson. Yes. Yeah, dad was a hard worker, a really stressed hard work, and mom was more academia. So I had the best of both worlds. You know, stressing hard work and also stressing scholarship.
Hmm. So what morals or ethics did you gain from dad? I mean, you say he was a hard worker and industrious, but, mm-hmm. you know, what's the story that you know, you share with him growing up and that really sticks with you?
With dad was, you know, never cheat a day. Never cheat a day. So we said at the end of the day, before you close your eyes, you know, did you cheat today? Did you get the most out of your day? He taught me that there's a lot of miracles that happen in your body just to allow you to get up in the morning. Your heart has to beat, pump blood through your body. Your lungs have to pump oxygen through your bodies. Your brain has to function. One thing doesn't work and you don't get up that day. So you never cheat a day because there's a lot of miracles that go on to allow you to get up, you know, and function during that day. One thing goes bad, you don't get up. So, you know, never cheat a day is what he always told me. But he definitely mandated hard work. There was no time for sitting around. And if you're sitting down, that means you were resting to get back to work again.
Mm. And you said mom was a scholar and pushed academia.
Absolutely.
What's something that sticks with you that you hear when you're making a decision day to day?
Mom was my biggest cheerleader growing up. I never got in trouble in school, but I do remember one time in school, a teacher told me, we had a debate and I didn't get in trouble in school, but it was my senior year. And, a teacher told me I wouldn't make it in college. And so I said, well, you did. And she said, well, there's a distinct difference between you and I. And I said, yes, there is. And so, you know, I usually don't debate, you know, with adults. I was never disrespectful, but that was my only time getting in trouble at school. And she kicked me out and told me to go to the principal's office. And I said, where is it? I didn't know where it was. And so I went to the main office. And then the next day they said, you know, you may get suspended. You may not be able to play football the next game. And I called my mom. And my mom left work at Pratt Whitney, came directly to the school and talked to them. She's like, nope, I don't want to talk about what happened with this incident. I know my son's not disrespectful. I want a meeting with that teacher who said my son's not going to be successful in college. And the principal hemmed and hawed, and she says, "Leonard, this doesn't involve you anymore. Go back to class." That was it. So that one, that one resonated. You know, she was a great supporter, but she knew her children. So I'm the youngest of three. I'm the only boy. I have two older sisters.
Okay, all right. That way. What are their names? Don't shine a little light on them.
Yeah, so I got Susan Jackson, Mac, and Linda Jackson, and those are my second and third moms, and they are equally as supportive and equally as protective, you know, as a parent. And I have great sisters, and we're really, really close. We have a great family dynamic, and people always applaud us, you know, for being so close and so tight, and they are my best friends.
It is time, you know, was there sibling rivalry? I mean, was there competition between you guys?
Maybe between the girls, but not with me.
Okay.
Not with me, no.
All right. Are you the baby?
I'm the baby. Oh. And I'm the only boy, so yes. It was a lot of nurturing and, you know, a lot of protection to this day.
I can see it in your work. Yeah. See, now it does make sense. Yes. It all adds up.
Absolutely.
You said you went to school here in the Hampton school system and all that. Was there any uncle, aunt, teacher outside of your dad and mom that really stood out that were, you know, gave you some good advice or at least?
I'm just going to go back to my dad. Hampton High was coming off a lot of race riots in the early 80s. I graduated in 1985. And so they have fraternities. You know, we didn't have gangs, but they have fraternities. And there was a black fraternity that basically stood, it was cultural, but also they stood for the protection and safety, you know, for the black male students more especially. I mean, they had race riots actually in the cafeteria in the early 80s that my sisters were involved in. And so I told my dad about it, and he says, "No, you're not going to be part of that." You know, it sounded like a gang. He said, "You got one gang, and that's the Jackson gang." And I remember Dad told me about peer pressure. And so one story that resonates, you know, I was 16 years old. My dad and I always worked on old school cars, muscle cars. So my first car was a 57 Chevy. I got when I was 12 years old, and we worked on it. My uncle had a cleaning business. My dad kept my checks every week. And then when I was 16, the car was ready, and he said, "Pick out your rims and your stereo." And so, but he gave me that talk, you know, the talk that you have, you know, with your black son about how to deal with the police, you know, where to go if something happens, you know, you pull over, you know, if a cop asks you for your ID, you give it to him, you get home that night. But a more important lesson that he had for me was about peer pressure. So I had some friends over, and my dad said, "You're a responsible young man, but I don't want him in your car." I said, "Dad, they're right here." He says, "I don't care. They're your friends. They're not mine." And he said, "They smoke reefer, and I don't want them in your car, and I'm here to protect you." And I said, "Well, Dad, what am I supposed to tell them?" And he said, "Well, tell them your father's an a-hole. I don't care what you tell them. You know, I'm here to protect you." And he says, "Damn it, they're walking. You want to walk with them?" And I said, "No, sir." And I bust out laughing. And remember the guys were saying, "Leonard, you're scared of your father." I said, "Well, I'm not scared of you. What's up?" You know, said, you know, there was a healthy fear I had of my dad, but it's more respectful. But he broke it down to me. He was like, "Listen, you can fight them or fight me. I think you have a better chance against them than me, you know. But again, if you want to walk, put them in your car. All of you will be walking together because they're not getting in your car." So he told me about peer pressure. I didn't have any peer pressure. I had daddy pressure.
That it means a lot to have that kind of attention and assertiveness and someone that wants to be in your life and drills themselves in your life. How important is that?
Yeah, absolutely. I always felt supported. Family was big. We always had extended family come up from down south that lived with us. So we always took care of family. We always vacationed together. So again, it wasn't just a nuclear family. It was extended family. And that transcended even afterward, when I became an adult. I'm a foster dad. My sisters are foster parents. My parents, they took in over 30 children. So they had 30 kids in their house, not at the same time, but over 25 years. But they moved back to Georgia after I graduated high school. So that's just what we do. That's just the culture. We just take care of folks, you know, that aren't even our family.
You're listening to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Candelario, and this is Jahad, as everyone calls him in the streets and everywhere I go. Now I understand the outpouring that you do in your community because so much was poured into you. With that said, how was navigating? Because you went to Hampden Hall, you went to some really good institutions.
Over to Hampden High.
Oh, Hampden High. Hampden. Okay, Hampden High. Which still was not easy at the time because I guess Hampden wasn't as segregated, I could say, or wasn't as what it is today, let's put it that way.
I know my graduating class, I think I counted, it was either 13 or 14 black males in my graduation class of 454. That was it back then. There wasn't a lot of us. So we really had to stick together. And culturally, you know, Hampden High wasn't there, you know, yet. You know, they've emerged throughout the years. But at that time, you know, I had a great high school experience, more especially because of sports. But it wasn't a bad experience, but it wasn't really a cultural experience.
Our parents make tough decisions for us to be put in better environments or in a better situation. Do you think your father at times questioned his decisions, or was he firm that this was best for my family?
Yes, absolutely. He was raised in segregated rural South, and you know, they wanted to do better for their children. And they said when the last child graduates, they would move back South. So actually the weekend of my prom, they were closing on a house back in Georgia. So, I wasn't on my own. They were like, you can come back to Georgia with us if you want, but, you know, you can go to school here or, you know. But they did make a better situation for us than they grew up in, but because, again, they were sharecroppers.
Mm. Wow. Yeah, so you can go back generations in your family.
Yeah, my mother's side, we've traced our roots back to the ship that ported in North Carolina, and my ancestors had to walk to Georgia, to Louisville, Georgia, actually where they were sold. We do have that history.
Wow. Good to know where you're from, right?
Absolutely.
To have that foundation so you know where you're going.
Absolutely.
That is the one thing that they say. So you went to college, you went away, you said?
Yeah, I did a year at Southern Connecticut, and then I went to Morris Brown College in Atlanta.
Okay, and how was that experience? Because, you know, when you go away from New Haven, it's eye-opening.
It was a great experience. I'd never been around, with the exception of my family and church, I'd never been around, you know, that many of my own people at the time. But one thing I immediately noticed is that the culture for learning was different. With teachers at Southern Connecticut, they weren't as readily caring and nurturing. I remember at Morris Brown College, it was a question in my math class, and I asked the teacher a question. They didn't explain it the way that I understood it, and one of my peers turned around, and girls started sliding their desks over, and you know, everyone just like immediately like started helping me. And then about a month later, I took the opportunity to skip the Tuesday class, and I showed up Thursday. So my teacher didn't believe that there were a lot of black people in Connecticut or no black people in Connecticut. So that was my name, Connecticut. Everyone called me Connecticut. And she said, Connecticut, where were you Tuesday? And I said, she said, before you make up a lie, just don't say nothing. You waste your time, not mine. Now go sit down, boy. I said, yes, ma'am. I went and sat down, and the students came around. They said, you okay? You okay? She lit me up, but you know, she came from a place of care. You know, the instructor was like an aunt. It's like family. So I really, really enjoyed my experience at Morris Brown.
You come back to New Haven.
Came back to New Haven.
A lot of people don't do that.
Yes, I came back to New Haven. Immediately I jumped into the Department of Corrections. So it actually is my junior year at Morris Brown College. I came back. I didn't have the money. this day. So I came back to, and I didn't want to burden my parents. So I came back to New Haven and had a 2-week run trying to sell drugs. So we're at the height of the crack epidemic in 1989 and tried to sell drugs. I was horrible at it. I was horrible. So I'm out there and, you know, my first name is Leonard. And I was hustling with some Jamaican guys, and this cop rolls up on me, this big cop, this big white cop, and he says, let me see some ID. So I show him my ID, and he says, oh, yeah, Leonard. I said, Leonard? I said, my name is Leonard. He said, no, you're Leonard. And I said, why do you keep messing my name up? My name is Leonard. And I stopped to think about it. How did Jamaicans say Leonard? Leonard. I said, someone gave my name up already. I said, I can't even do this right. And so the cop, we had a good conversation. He was like, you're not cut out for this, dude. You know, he's like, what do you want out of life? I said, I want to be successful. I don't know what I want to do. So he said, you like guns? I said, yeah. He said, you like money? I said, sure. He said, you like fast cars? I said, yeah. He said, you want respect? I was like, you're asking me all this obvious stuff. I said, what are you getting at? He said, well, be a cop. We'll give you a gun. We'll give you a car. Drive as fast as you want. We'll give you a badge. You get respect. We'll give you a nice salary and a pension. Everything that you want, you know, from the streets, you can get if you come working with us. And he says, but this is the thing that got me. He said, what would your mother think right now? And, man, that hit me like a dagger. And so my mother poured so much and invested so much in me. So he says, if I see you out here again, we're going to have a different conversation. He said, now get out of here. And I think I knew what he meant, because New Haven had, they had the Dirty Boys back then, the police. They had the beat down posse. The cops would jump out on you, beat you down, take your drugs, your money, your gun, and just leave you in a gutter. And they drove a white van. I think that's what he was referring to. So that night, while attempting to sleep, I'm like, how did I get here? I ran to the Army recruiter station next morning. I said, give me the first thing out of here. And they did. I went to basic training at Fort Dix. I came back. I learned so much that summer. And I came back. I was ready for the world. So I was going into my senior year in college. And so joined Department of Corrections, got my bachelor's degree. They were paying 75% of tuition, and I kept going and got my master's degree. Left corrections after 10 years, went to probation, became a supervisor. And lo and behold, older guy, retired cop comes in. He says, I used to be on the street, you know, I'll just come and I'll type warrants or whatever you need. So we're like, oh, it seems like a nice guy. We'll hire him. And I was talking to him about, you know, things in the past and, you know, his experiences. And he told me what area he worked in. I said, man, I said, this big white cop scared the crap out of me one day, man. I told him the story. He just kept looking at me. And then he says, did you drive a blue Camaro? I said, I had a Trans Am. I said, with gold rims. He said, Georgia plates? I said, yeah. He said, damn it, that was me. Same cop that got me off the streets. I ended up hiring him and became his boss. And then the cop's name is John Bashta. He can confirm the story. He owns Bash's Martial Arts in Hamden. He's a great guy. He's still a great guy to this day. But, you know, right then, both of us, I think we hugged each other. He was like, damn it, I knew I did something good with my career. And I'm saying, I said, man, so thank you so much for changing my life. But we shared that story. And, you know, he's like, yeah, this guy's my boss now. You know, I chased him off the streets.
Full circle moment.
Absolutely.
Wow. You're listening to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, the rhythm of the city. I'm Jose Candelario here with the big bro, Jihad. Well, we call him Leonard, but I don't know. I always known you as Jihad. Everyone calls you Jihad.
No one calls me Leonard except my mother.
Where did Jihad come from? You're Jackson.
I was Jackson, yeah. I had some experiences back. I was an active member of Emmanuel Baptist Church growing up. I always loved religion. And then my freshman year, I embraced the Nation of Islam. And then from there, I converted to Orthodox Islam as a Sunni Muslim when I was in the army. And so from there, I practiced Islam, always practiced Islam from the time I was 19 years old. And in 2001, I actually made the name change. My mother helped me select the name. And it, Jihad means honesty, prosperity, sincerity, royalty. So it's Jihad, not Jihad. So there'd be no holy wars going on. But so Jihad is actually a Swahili name.
You're making bold decisions in your life to make your life even more difficult. I mean, you're a black man in America. Now you want to be part of the Nation of Islam. I mean, why? Why?
It gave me peace and balance. You know, I want, when people say jihad, that means that's something I have to live up to. You know, honesty, sincerity, prosperity, royalty. So when I hear jihad, that's what I have to live up to. You know, and also, you know, with my children, I wanted, you know, them to have that name. You know, the Jackson name, you know, was proud, but the Jackson name also came from my great-grandfather on my father's side, as far as I could go back. And he was a rapist. He was a rapist. So he raped my great-grandmother. And I just didn't want that name. I didn't want that part of the name. So they were like, it's not who you are, it's what you answer to. I wanted to answer to jihad. You know, so, you know, it keeps me on my toes also. It gives me balance.
Something to say about breaking cyclical trauma in our family. I think that was, that's a big step in doing that.
My dad wasn't that happy about it initially. And, you know, because he's LJ. I was named after him. So that's why I kept the J and respect to dad. But he didn't like it. But until he was put into a position to defend me, because one of his sisters, you know, ridiculed me and said something about me. You know, he doesn't know what he wants to do. He's lost. He's aimless. And he said, hey, hey, that's a good man right there. You know, he takes care of his children. He's, he does great community work. He's a nice young man. He's successful. You know, what right do you have to tell him what path he takes, as long as he's a good man and he believes in God? So after that, he's like, all right, I'm not going to call you that. My family name is Boo anyway, so he just still called me Boo.
We're learning a lot today. I will not be calling a grown man Boo, but
that's the family name.
Okay.
It worked out in college when I was trying to play football as Boo Jackson, because Auburn had this guy named Bo Jackson. He was just a little bit better than me. So I was Boo Jackson at Morris Brown College.
Bo, I wonder who that guy turned out to be.
He did pretty well for himself.
Wow. You've navigated the correction system and probation. So you have a lot of experience in seeing people make bad decisions. Why? What is the allure of the street that really compels our young brown and black men to make those economic financial decisions that are fast and lucrative?
Well, you said it. They're fast and they're lucrative. You know, there's a lot of factors that contribute, you know, to community violence and making those decisions. You know, sometimes it's that family, you know, dynamic. My family dynamic is we take care of other people. We care for people who aren't even in our family. That's kind of like the family business. But gangs call one another family. You know, if you're not getting that love and that support and that nurturing in the home, you're going to go out in the streets and get it. And everyone's always trying to perfect the game. You can't perfect the game, because a lot of the times the game is not even within your hands or your capacity to even control it. You know, you're dealing with snitches, stick up boys, cops, and you get arrested. Now you're dealing with bond, lawyer, sentencing, and then, you know, being away from your family. There's so much that's involved and entangled with that. And then, you know, we just have to navigate our way through, you know, structural racism. You know, New Hallville, I bought my first house in Hazel Street. And I walked through there, you know, often. And, you know, just a dearth of nutrition. You know, their bodegas, the healthiest thing you can get from there is probably, you know, a sandwich, you know, but we're not getting any fruits, any vegetables or anything else like that. I always wondered in the hood why you can get a big jug of, you know, we call it a base head juice or quarter water for 99 cents. But then if you want regular water, it costs $4. You know,
what are you talking about? I mean, when I was in the hood at Bob's store on Newhall Street, it was 25 cents for that little jug.
That's the little jug. I'm talking about the big jug.
The big jug. I couldn't afford that.
Oh, the gallon? Yeah, the gallon was 99 cents.
Oh, that in your time. Okay, you got 10 years on me.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the healthiest store at Bob's was the pig feet.
That's what you had pickle. To pick, and you had the to pickle. Pick. You could pick the one you want. Give me that one right there. I want that one.
And the pickle. That's it. You had two pickle. Choices. That was your veggie.
Because I go back to the egg. They had the egg in there too. They had a boiled egg in there.
Yep.
Yeah.
The pickled egg.
I don't want to talk about the pig feet. I did partake in the pig feet at one point in my life. And I used to point out the pig feet. They put in a cellophane bag for you. Yes, sir. Heard about it.
Yeah. Okay. We ain't gonna throw you under the bus heard with that.
It. Yes, sir.
But, you know, young men right now, we talk about emotional maturity intelligence because that's now the key thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How to express yourself. Why are we so angry? Is this an institutionalized, colonial, you know, hand-me-down for us?
Absolutely. I'm books like Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome by Dr. Joy DeGruy, they talk about it, you know, how certain things are passed down. And, you know, what choice would you have except to be angry? And as a man, you know, everything that we've faced in the past, you know, being called a boy, being not treated like a man, you know, then you come back home and you're inflicting punishment and abuse upon your family, you know, because at one point in your life, they could just take your children away. And then men are taught, you know, to suppress your feelings, you know, be a man, you know, man up. And we don't have opportunities to really let go, you know, of those emotions. Because if you go see a clinician, they're like, oh, what's wrong with you? Something must be wrong with you. And in the black community, it's better to be a drug addict than just say, like, there's something not right or something, you know, I need more assistance with, you know, my mental health, you know, my anxiety, my depression, you know, and there's a stigma involved in that. And that's why a lot of us, even myself, you know, they're like, have you been in counseling? I was like, no, but listen, I'm a Mason. I talk to my brothers. You know, we sit in the garage, we smoke cigars, and we'll sit back and we'll kick it. I'm a member of Phi Beta Sigma Fraternity Incorporated. I get around some good men, and we talk, you know, and sometimes you have to break that ice and talk about those things. I said, listen, we're in a safe space here, you know, and we could talk about certain things, and we do. So I'm able to get those things out. A lot of times people aren't in positive networks such as those organizations, and those their cliques or their groups aren't as positive. They don't talk about goals. They have to worry about being ridiculed and stuff like that, so they just suppress it. So it's real. That part is real. You know, the anger and everything is real. And I see young men and even young women, you know.
Especially now, young women, God, more and more.
Brother, we started a program called Makerspace at my agency that deals with 7th and 8th grade girls who are just fighting and fighting. I don't know if you've broken up a fight lately, but guys will say, young boys will say, run me a 30. That's 30 seconds. Win, lose, or draw, 30 seconds, they're breaking it up. And they're usually looking for someone to break it up after 30 seconds. It's like hockey. They'll fight. As soon as someone goes to the ground, they put them in the headlock, it's over. These girls will keep pulling hair and kicking, you know, like their life depended on it for minutes. And once they got that kung fu grip on that hair, it's really, really hard to get their hands free. Mm-hmm. But they will just keep fighting because they're suppressing so much anger, so much depression and trauma and abuse. Mm-hmm. I didn't recognize how many young ladies have been abused. They said one out of every four young girls have been abused in their life. And it's probably understated because that's reported. And so when we look at trauma, depression, anxiety, and those factors that contribute to it, of course they'd be angry. Mm.
Mm. And here you are acknowledging the pain, acknowledging the trauma, giving them the attention.
Absolutely.
I mean, how powerful is simply paying attention or checking in. I think, I mean, you have young and youth and you've done work, and the check-in is probably the most powerful tool you have as a mentor now.
Absolutely. And I get it. And again, I've learned so much from the young people that I work with. There's a young lady. If you ever look at my documentary, if you go on YouTube, it's under Witness Greatness on YouTube. We did a documentary that's it's about 40 minutes long. But there's a young lady on there who I work with. Actually, I coached her dad in football, and they were talking about how angry she was. And so when I talked to her, she had been abused by a family member, and no one believed her. And then when they finally believed her, the person, it was her grandmother's boyfriend. He was arrested. The case was pending. He passed away while the case was still pending. And the family basically said, oh, okay, well, he can't hurt you anymore. You're all set. And she just became angry. And so she went to counseling. Then she went to counseling again. And then she went to counseling again. Now she's 13, 14 years old. And so when I met her and I said, listen, I want you to talk to someone. I want you to go to counseling. She said, I'll go if you want me to go, but it's not going to help. I said, well, you have to give it a try. And she's like, no, they need to give me a chance. Every time I go to counseling, the counselor leaves. So it's an intern or it's someone who just graduated college, you know, the entry level, and they get another opportunity and then they leave or they get promoted. And she has to start her story over and over again. So she's like, I'll rock with you, but you just got to promise, you know, you won't leave me because everybody leaves me. I said, no, I'm not going anywhere. She's like, well, why can't I just talk to you? I said, you can, but I'm not a clinician. I said, so let's do both. So she did trust me and she went back. But the clinician left her. Another clinician left her. So I've been like one of the constants in her life. But usually if you know, the kids will test you. You know, they've been left on the porch waiting for dad. People start relationships and then they'll end the relationships. And, you know, we start doing organizational mentoring, you know, rather than just being a one-on-one. You know, one person may let you down, but usually not a whole organization will let you down. So that's something that we're working on right now as an organization.
You're listening to the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, The Rhythm of the City. I'm Jose Candelario. This is Jihad. Now, no one calls him Leonard or Boo. We're just going to call him Jihad. Leave it at that. Final minutes here. And I usually give the floor to the person. You can say whatever you want. Floor is yours, sir.
I just want to congratulate New Haven. I'll just say, you know, I borrowed this from Phi Beta Sigma Fraternity Incorporated. We have a culture for service and a service for humanity. Everyone wants to do something good for youth in New Haven. You know, whether it's individual, neighborhoods, even municipalities, fraternities, everyone wants to help. It just has to be organized. The police, there's not too many police that have partnerships with an agency like mine, Connecticut Violence Intervention and Prevention.
CTVIP for short.
CTVIP. So that's why I go to conferences around the country. They always ask me, how do you get along with the police? You know, how did you get into the schools? How do you have a relationship with the hospital? You know, and we do. And that's why things work in New Haven. You know, there's several municipalities, local, similarly situated like New Haven. They don't have the relationship that we have, you know, that creates this ecosystem, you know, where who can best serve this youth. I get a call from the police chief. I've even gotten calls from the feds. Jihad, this kid is coming off the porch. Can you get a hold of this kid before he gets out in the street? And the cops will always call me. Jihad, talk to this kid. Can you please talk to him? And we do. So it does work. I wish a lot of other places would replicate what we do, but it is commendable, the work from the Connecticut State Police, you know, led by Commissioner Ron L. Higgins. I'm always getting calls from him. You know, how can we get better relationships, you know, with the community? Locally, Carl Jacobson, I never met a chief like him. He's a great guy. He's a great friend. it took him a while to build some trust. He came down here with that Boston Providence accent. He's a Red Sox fan. And, you know, you just can't trust those people, those Red Sox fans. But over a while, it took a while, but we have not a, just a relationship, but a friendship. You know, we can call each other and talk. But again, when he was lieutenant, he went out to the Newhallville reunion on his dime. It was hot. It was like the heat index was 104. He came out with coolers of water and ice and just started handing them out to people. And at that part, at that point of his career, he was kicking indoors. But, you know, he was giving out water also. Mm. So, and, you know, he's chief now. And he's helped change the culture, just as Chief Reynolds has done in Hamden also. And Chief Perno is working on in West Haven. So what we're doing is working. You know, people say, you know, they said crime is down. I know, listen, if you have one murder, that's too much. But the numbers, you know, and the data doesn't lie. Certain things you can kind of manipulate, but a shooting and a homicide, you can't manipulate that data. And those numbers are down.
Long, long time since those Billy White days.
Ooh. And Billy White is a, Billy White was someone that I worked with, you know, and I worked in the prison. I was working protective custody, and he would talk to folks, you know, that were in protective custody, and then we talked. And my house is actually burglarized on Hazel Street, and Billy was the first one there. So Billy White did a lot of harm to the community. Personally, you know, we did have I wouldn't call it a relationship, but or friendship, but I guess it's like more like a working relationship. But for the record, I never gave him any information. but he was a good cop. He went rogue, but he was a good cop.
Well, there you go. Wow. So we can stay here and talk about New Haven history. Thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely. Jihad, I appreciate it.
I mean, I just call you Jihad. I don't know what else to call you, sir. With that said, thank you so much for your time. This has been the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC, The Rhythm of the City. This is Leonard Jihad, CTVIP. If you know of a youth that needs some kind of direction, or if you're out there and you are an adult and you need to, someone to talk to, CTVIP is there. What's the number?
Check the website. Everything's on the website, www.ctintervention.org, or just pull up on us at 230 Ashman Street in the Dixwell section of New Haven.
Wow, you can just pull up and get that help. Thank just you so much up. For your time. This has been the Electric Drum on 94.3 WYBC. I'm Jose Candelario. Leonard Jihad, and like always, to everyone out there, thank you for listening.